Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
With the new Dexcom G7, you can achieve better diabetes results without painful finger sticks. It sends your glucose numbers to your compatible phone or watch, so you can always see where you are and where you're heading. See how food and exercise affects your glucose, making it easier to spend more time in range and lower your A1C. Take control of your diabetes with the number one recommended CGM brand. It's easy to get started today at Dexcom.com. That's Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom. Dexcom.com/compatibility.
Pretty much any obituary with the word first in its headline is going to get a lot of clicks. Of course it is. The human drama is baked right in. Someone doing something unprecedented captivates us. We can only imagine the courage, the fortitude, not to mention the talent, of Jackie Robinson, the first black player in Major League Baseball. But what about the black player who joined the major leagues just 11 weeks after Robinson?
He had the weight of an entire race on his shoulders, along with Jackie Robinson.
Sally Ride's place in history is secure. She was the first American woman in space. But what about the woman who went into orbit only a year later?
She approached becoming an astronaut like she did everything. She knew what she wanted and went for it.
The same woman who lost her life on one of the darkest days in NASA's history.
You saw it 45 seconds after liftoff, a huge fireball in the sky.
And what about the British band?
Here they are again. Let's have a nice welcome.
Who landed on American shores only a month after the Beatles invaded.
Here they come again. Can't you see we can?
We love firsts so much that we end up ignoring the achievements and people that come after, even right after. But those people are essential. Without someone coming in second and third and fourth, the first person is more of an oddity, a one-off, instead of the beginning of big social change. So today, we salute three of history's silver medalists. From CBS Sunday Morning and iHeart, I'm Mo Rocca, and this is Mobituaries. This Mobit, second place finishers, Larry Doby, Judith Resnick, and the Dave Clark Five. I love a good musical rivalry. Andy Williams versus Perry Como. Metallica versus Megadeth. Does anyone else remember that period in the early 80s when it was Madonna versus Cyndi Lauper? Well, for a good stretch of 1964, you were either a Beatles person or a Dave Clark Five person. I know, you thought I was going to mention the Stones. But in 1964, there were magazine covers pitting the Beatles against the Dave Clark Five. On one of them, there's a picture of band leader Dave Clark captioned, "I'll duel with Ringo." And only 1 month after the Fab Four's legendary first appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show.
Here, for all of you youngsters, England's Dave Clark Five, glad all over. So let's
the Dave Clark Five made their first appearance on the program. The Dave Clark Five had good reason to be feeling glad all over. Their hit of the same name had knocked the Beatles' I Want to Hold Your Hand out of the top spot on the UK charts. Throughout the 60s, they would land 15 consecutive top 20 U.S. hit singles and sell 100 million records.
You want a pounding rocker of a record, a rip-it-up song that will rattle your world in the bedroom you share with your dad and your brother.
Tom Hanks grew up listening to the group and could barely contain himself during their induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2008.
You want to hear a song that will make you feel glad all over by the Dave Clark Five.
After the DC Five's breakthrough with Glad All Over, 1964 saw them score top five hits with Bits and Pieces. Can't You See That She's Mine? And Because. The following year, they went to number one with Over and Over.
I said over and over and over again, the Dave Clark Five made a joyful sound. Over and over and over again, the Dave Clark Five made a joyful sound.
But unlike the Beatles, who were determined from their earliest days in Liverpool to make it as artists, the Dave Clark Five started playing music to support their soccer habit.
They had a soccer team, and they wanted to play in a tournament in Holland, but they didn't have the money for the passage.
This is Harold Bronson, co-founder of Rhino Records. He wrote a book about the British invasion.
So they formed a band to make money so that they could actually be able to go to Holland, which they did.
Their aspiration was to go to Holland and play soccer, and being a band was the way they were going to pay for it, was basically their survival job.
Right. So it was kind of an accident, you know, that they evolved into this really good dance band who were, you know, making money.
Mike Smith played keyboards and sang lead. His voice was raw, commanding, and he helped write many of the group's songs. Lenny Davidson played guitar, Rick Huxley was on bass, and Dennis Payton, the saxophone, a wild card that helped give the Dave Clark Five a unique sound. But what really set the band apart was its drummer, Dave Clark himself. A former stuntman, he wasn't just the band's leader, a rarity for a drummer. He also managed the band with a crystal clear vision of how it should sound and look. More than anything, he was a showman.
The Dave Clark Five probably had the best presentation of any of the British invasion groups when they came to America, because Dave was thinking more theatrical.
They looked great. I mean, these guys were snappy dressers, matching suits, white turtlenecks, pocket squares. Their perfectly clean-cut hair, perfectly coiffed. I call it Fisher-Price hair, like each head of hair could snap right on and off.
Well, it's time to go on in a few seconds, so Mike and Rick attend to their hairdos. Nothing fantastic, no hint of Merseyside, but just the way their fans expect to see them.
On stage, they were all smiles, bobbing their heads side to side in unison, in sync with their leader's drum beat. Dave was also a producer on the group's records, a very hands-on producer. The drums, for example, he made sure they were always mixed loud.
I still love you. Everybody knows she's been hanging around.
And Dave exhibited a business savvy that's rare among new artists. He had paid for studio recordings himself, using money from his stunt work, so he figured he could ask for more than the standard royalty rate.
And when he went into negotiation, he figured, okay, I'll ask for three times as much. And the record company basically said, okay.
Even more audaciously, he asked that the rights to the group's songs be returned to him after 10 years.
Which again, they said, okay, because they weren't paying for it. And rock and roll wasn't thought to have any longevity.
That's right. The company didn't see a future for rock and roll. But Dave Clark, the stuntman slash soccer enthusiast slash high school dropout, did. Now that's smarts. Once the band topped the charts in the UK, it was inevitable that America's most important tastemaker would come calling.
And now, here he is, Ed Sullivan.
Ed Sullivan's variety show had ruled Sunday nights for decades. And once the Beatles appeared, Sullivan's show became the gateway, kind of the Ellis Island, for British bands who wanted to make it in America. All the more remarkable, then, that when Ed Sullivan first invited the Dave Clark Five on, Dave actually said no. In today's terms, that's like having a store on Etsy and turning down Oprah when she calls to tell you you're one of her favorite things. But Harold Bronson says Clark had played for Americans on air bases in the UK, and, well, apparently they were just too American for him.
He did not have a good impression of Americans and didn't want to, like, put himself in that kind of rowdy, uncouth element. But when Ed Sullivan upped the ante to $10,000, well, you know, that was a lot of money, and that made all the difference.
After Ed Sullivan introduced the Dave Clark Five to America, they finally quit their day jobs. They ended up going on his show 12 times. In November 1964, the group played Anaheim, and the LA Times described the event as a riot without violence. The headline, Britons find it hard to sing to 3,000 screaming teenagers. It was Beatlemania-level frenzy. In fact, just 1 year after the Beatles charmed audiences with their movie A Hard Day's Night, the Dave Clark Five starred in their own film called Catch Us If You Can.
Catch us if you can. Catch us if you can.
The movie marked the debut of British director John Borman, who went on to make Deliverance and Hope and Glory. But even before the film came out, Borman told the press it was a dud. The Dave Clark Five, mainly Dave himself, just couldn't match the Beatles' charisma. Dave may have been cruising around in a Jaguar in the movie, but the band's joyride was beginning to sputter. By the latter half of the 60s, the Beatles were experimenting with new sounds and psychedelic drugs. They went to India and studied transcendental meditation. They released groundbreaking albums like Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Critics began praising their music as art. Meanwhile, the Dave Clark Five were relying more and more on covers. For the record, I happen to love their take on Put a Little Love in Your Heart. In 1970, the Dave Clark Five called it quits, the same year that the Beatles broke up. Today, more than half a century later, there really is no competition. Culturally, the Beatles are still playing the main stage. The Dave Clark Five, for a time, were all but forgotten. That was thanks to a very bad business decision by Dave himself to sit on those rights that reverted to him. For decades, he simply refused to re-release any of the group's music. He thought, wrongly, that that would make the songs more valuable. But none of that changes the fact that the Dave Clark Five put out a lot of great records. Records that made a deep impact in this country. I want to go back to those early months of 1964, when the Beatles in February and the Dave Clark Five in March first came to America. They were coming to a country at its lowest low, still traumatized from what had happened just a few months before, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. In his speech inducting the DC Five into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Tom Hanks remembered how it felt.
In November of 1963, a terrible storm pounded your classroom and your town and your country. And for weeks and for months, for the longest time, your heart and your world have been wrapped in black, and the head of every single person you look up to is still bowed in mourning. It was the bleakest winter of your discontent, but then mourning became morning as the sun rose in the east. Coming out of England.
For many Americans, the British invasion was more of an intervention, jolting this country from its sad stupor. Music as a kind of therapy, scream therapy.
The result was more than just audiences filled with screaming teenagers and schoolyard arguments over who was better, this quintet or that quartet from the northern part of the Queen's Isle. No, the true product was joy.
The Dave Clark Five may have been second to the Beatles, and only for a short time at that. But both groups delivered joy when people really needed it. I'll let Tom Hanks, channeling his 8-year-old self, close out this set.
Music reaches the soul. The Dave Clark Five lifted ours with a concussive beat that commanded you to lean over from the back seat the moment you heard the rumbling percussion of the Dave Clark Five on the radio, and commanded you to yell at your dad, "Turn it up! Turn it up, Dad! This is my favorite song!" And this song is going to take our confusion and our sadness, our loss and our despair. It's going to take all the bleak days we've been through and all the heaviness of our hearts. This 3-minute record is taking our joylessness and smashing it to pieces, to bits and pieces. So turn off the radio, Dad!
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Rain or shine, every day is a great day for fishing, right? You got rain gear, but you can't overlook sunny day gear. A Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie has you covered on the sunniest days. Like, literally. I mean, who wouldn't trade a sunburn for a trophy fish? But why do it if you don't have to? Especially when this Solar Stream Elite hoodie is built with broad-spectrum UV protection. We're talking UPF 50, and it has airflow so you don't overheat. And what's the alternative? Putting down the rod every half hour so you can slather on some sunscreen. Seems like an easy choice to me. Columbia PFG has you covered with their Castback TC shoe. Its OmniMax cushioning and traction system helps if you're on your feet a lot, say, fighting a fish. Not to mention keeping you sure-footed on a wet rocking boat. So if you're going to be spending long days out on the water, and I sincerely hope that you will be, head over to Columbia.com/PFG and shop all their performance fishing gear.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Now, if you heard our season one episode on Forgotten Forerunners, you may remember the story of Moses Fleetwood Walker, the black baseball player who in 1884 joined the lineup of the otherwise white Toledo Blue Stockings. His taking the field outraged enough white players that a color line was soon drawn through America's pastime. For the next 6 decades, there was an apartheid in American baseball. Black players had to form their own teams and eventually their own leagues, the Negro Leagues. Then Jackie Robinson moved from the Negro Leagues to a Brooklyn Dodgers farm team, and then in 1947 was called up to become the first black player in Major League Baseball, a milestone that was much bigger than baseball.
Here at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, we make the bold assertion that Jackie Robinson's breaking of the color barrier wasn't just a part of the civil rights movement. It was the beginning of the civil rights movement.
That's Bob Kendrick, the president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City, Missouri.
This is 1947. This is well before Brown versus the Board of Education.
Right.
This is before Rosa Parks' refusal to move to the back of the bus. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was merely a sophomore at Morehouse College. in essence, this is what started the ball of social progress rolling in our country, baseball. And our country literally jumped on the coattail of baseball.
Kendrick was speaking to CBS for a documentary, not about Jackie Robinson, but about the second black player in the major leagues.
This is a CBS New York special presentation. Larry Doby, second to none.
My colleague, sports anchor Otis Livingston, hosted that documentary. Otis felt it was high time that Larry Doby got his due.
Because he has his own place. Jackie, of course, is number one, first guy in. But just 11 weeks later, he was brought into this whole situation.
Doby's journey as the second black player in the MLB was uniquely challenging.
Is it fair to say that he suffered the same indignities as Jackie Robinson, but he didn't get the same accolades?
Oh, that's fair to say. It's really fair.
Larry Doby was born in 1923 in Camden, South Carolina. When he was 14, he moved to Paterson, New Jersey, the place he would call home. Doby had played baseball when he was in South Carolina, but in New Jersey, he became a star, and not just in baseball. He played on Eastside High School's championship-winning football team. He broke a conference record in track and field. In fact, while he was good at baseball, he'd later tell the Louis B. Nunn Center for Oral History that the sport was almost like an afterthought.
I never thought that much about baseball. Even when I was in high school, I played baseball because there was nothing else to do.
Baseball may not have been his passion back then, but he made the All-State team 2 years in a row. His high school gave him a gold watch, naming him the greatest Eastside high school athlete of all time.
So he was used to a relatively supportive atmosphere.
Exactly.
Now, when Doby was coming up, there was no explicit rule barring black players from the major leagues. But there was a tacit understanding among team owners. You just didn't sign black players. So Doby joined the Negro Leagues in 1942 while he was still in high school and began playing for the Newark Eagles as second baseman. He played under the name Larry Walker since high school students weren't technically allowed to play. It was his first professional contract. His rising star was briefly interrupted by World War II when Doby was drafted into the Navy. He rode a train to Chicago for basic training, along with some of his former high school teammates. But unlike his high school, the Navy was segregated.
There was a bunch of kids that had played football with me and baseball with me in high school. We were on the same train. When we got to Chicago, it was then we were separated. I went to the so-called Camp Robert Small, which was a black camp, and they went to the white camp.
In the Navy, there was an all-white baseball team called the Blue Jackets. But Doby and other black players could only play for the Black Blue Jackets. Doby later said that it was the first time he was fully conscious of segregation, and it stung. After all, he was drafted into the Navy to fight for the country.
You became a little bit frustrated because you didn't know what was going on. And you're the same kids as you played with in high school. All of a sudden, you know, you're not together.
But by the time Doby left the Navy and rejoined the Newark Eagles, change was in the wind. Jackie Robinson had just joined the farm team for the National League Brooklyn Dodgers, the first step in the breaking of the color barrier. And some other owners were looking to integrate their teams. One of them was Bill Veeck, the owner of the American League Cleveland Indians. Bill Veeck would later be lauded for his early role in bringing black players into the majors. He would also end up hiring the American League's first black public relations officer, trainer, and scout. In 1947, as Jackie Robinson took the field in Brooklyn, Veeck told his scouts to look for the Negro League's player with the best long-term potential, and Doby's name kept floating to the top. And so Veeck made a deal with the Newark Eagles to bring Doby to Cleveland.
But he went about it in a much different way than the Brooklyn Dodgers went about bringing Jackie Robinson on. Yeah,
because they brought him through the minor league system and gave him a little bit of an adjustment period. This was more abrupt.
In other words, Robinson's introduction to the majors had been carefully orchestrated. Larry Doby's was not. On July 4th, 1947,
Dobie played what would be his last game with the Negro Leagues.
And then he was whisked away on a train bound for Chicago to meet his Cleveland Indian teammates to play against the Chicago White Sox the next day.
Because I was leaving a bunch of guys that I'd played with for a long time, so I felt a little funny about that. But no thoughts came into my head about the major leagues. I thought more about what I'm leaving.
Dobie was newly married. He and his wife, Helen, had been looking forward to buying a house in New Jersey when Dobie suddenly found himself on that train headed to the Midwest. Larry Dobie was also young. Jackie Robinson was 28 when he joined the Dodgers.
So he was seasoned. He could probably handle it a little different. Larry Doby's 23 years old.
And let's talk about that, because that's an important distinction. 28 and 23, those are two very different ages.
Yes, definitely. I mean, you're a pup at 23, you know? You're experiencing this stuff for the first time.
Joining the Cleveland Indians would make Dobie the first black player in the American League. Not that his teammates rolled out the red carpet.
What kind of a reception did he get in Chicago on July 5th when he shows up there?
Okay, some were receptive, some wouldn't shake his hand, some turned their backs. You know, there was just a litany of responses.
When the team took to the field to warm up, no one would even play catch with Dobie, except for second baseman and former American League MVP, Joe Gordon. Gordon said to Dobie, "Hey, rookie, you gonna just stand there or do you want to throw a little?" Dobie later said it was a moment he would never forget.
You have to have allies when you're doing something like this, when you're taking on an endeavor like this, which was difficult for him on and off the field. You have to have somebody in your corner that's going to accept you and make it okay or make it tolerable.
Joe Gordon aside, Dobie's first major league season was rough. He struck out more than twice as often as he had playing for the Newark Eagles.
If you would ask me as to why I wasn't a consistent ball player, I couldn't give you an answer. Now, it had to be something subconsciously that I had no control over, I knew nothing about.
His early performance probably had something to do with the almost inconceivable pressure he and Jackie Robinson were under. Here's Bob Kendrick from the Negro Leagues Museum again.
Jackie Robinson, Larry Dobie, they were carrying 21 million black folks on their back. So if they fail, an entire race of people fail. Can you imagine carrying that weight in a sport that is predicated on failure?
Yes.
Baseball is a game of failure at its crux.
In other words, in a game where striking out is the norm, black players couldn't really afford to strike out.
Even under the best of circumstances, you're under extraordinary psychic strain.
Mm-hmm.
So add to that,
mm-hmm.
some people would come to the games for the express purpose of jeering him, of insulting him.
Oh, yeah. It was a microcosm of the world itself or our country itself. I mean, that's what it was like at that time.
And Otis Livingston says it's not like things were any easier off the field.
Couldn't stay in the same hotels with his teammates. Couldn't eat at the same restaurants. His family was not there to even lean on.
Dobie's second season with the Indians got off to an equally rocky start. He worried that if he didn't turn things around, he'd be demoted and sent to play in the minor leagues. But in May 1948, he hit his stride. And by the end of the season, he'd brought his batting average up to .301, one of the best on the team. And later that year, Dobie set another milestone. He and his teammate, Satchel Paige, who had joined the Indians from the Negro Leagues that July, became the first black players to make it to the World Series. Game 4 of that series between Cleveland and the Boston Braves would be one of the most important of his life. In the third inning, with two outs, Dobie stepped up to the plate. First pitch, strike. But on the second pitch, Dobie hit the ball hard.
Indian Dobie rockets Sane's high, fast pitch for a trip to Mars. A lethal wallop more than 400 feet into the right field crowd. Dobie's round trip is the first home run of the series.
Larry Dobie became the first black player to hit a home run in a World Series, a game-winning home run. But what happened afterward between Dobie and Cleveland pitcher Steve Gromek may be even more significant.
After the game, they rush into the clubhouse, jubilant, happy, And a photographer from the Associated Press captures the image of Gromyk and Doby hugging each other with big smiles on their face.
It's a completely wonderful photograph. If you haven't seen it, I urge you to Google it. The smiles on their faces, the sheer joy. They're like two little boys who just couldn't be happier to be playing with each other.
They're cheek to cheek, but also their arms, just they're
intertwined.
Right.
It's almost symbolic of becoming one against all odds, not just the baseball odds, but against this segregation.
The photo ran in newspapers across the country. Americans everywhere saw a black man and a white man embrace in celebration.
It became a symbol of this great experiment of getting along, playing together, accomplishing something, and just loving each other.
For his special, Otis asked Doby's son, Larry Doby Jr., about the picture.
When I see it, I just see two people who are extremely happy they won, and they don't care about what color skin each one is. It's just like they love each other for winning. One guy pitched great, one guy hit great, and they're just overjoyed. Probably my father's happiest moment in baseball.
The love continued as the team went on to win the 1948 World Series.
And the 1948 World Series is all over. The Cleveland Indians take the series 4-2.
After the final out of the final game, the players ran onto the infield. You could see it in the video. Doby's number 14 gets lost in the celebrating swarm.
Every man on the team shares credit for the crown.
The weird part about it, too, was years later, he would admit that he really didn't think of it as a big deal. Bill Veeck kept telling him, you're going to make history. You're making history. You're doing this. And he didn't really grasp it at the time, you know, as he was going through it.
When Doby and Cleveland won that World Series in 1948, there were just 5 black players in the majors, less than 1% of the league. By the time Doby retired from baseball in 1962, 10% of major league players were black. 3 years after the World Series win, the people of Paterson, New Jersey, helped pay off the rest of their hometown hero's mortgage. Doby burned the mortgage paperwork before a game against the New York Yankees. By the way, years after he retired as a player, Larry Doby went on to become the manager of the Chicago White Sox, the second black manager in Major League Baseball. Larry Doby was 79 when he died on June 18, 2003. But he lived to see his number retired by Cleveland in 1994. And in 1998, in Cooperstown, New York, he was inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame.
It's a very tough thing to look back and think about things that were probably negative, because you put those things on the back burner. You're proud and happy that you've been a part of integrating baseball to show people that we can live together, we can work together, we can play together, and we can be successful together. And I'm very happy and proud that I've been a part of this baseball, and I'm still a part of it.
Occasionally, during their earliest days in the major leagues, Jackie Robinson and Larry Doby would talk over the phone at night, after games, sharing their experiences. It makes sense. These were two men who, for a time, were the only ones who really understood what the other one was going through. In a league all by themselves. Both of them history makers.
Jackie Robinson's breaking of Major League Baseball's color barrier carried the same level of euphoria that we saw as a nation when Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. So for black folks, Jackie Robinson was our Neil Armstrong.
Right.
He was the proverbial first man to walk on the moon. Well, Larry Doby is our Buzz Aldrin.
Speaking of astronauts, coming up, the story of the second American woman in space.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit TrinitySchool.org for more info now.
Rain or shine, every day is a great day for fishing, right? You got rain gear, but you can't overlook sunny day gear. A Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie has you covered on the sunniest days. Like, literally. I mean, who wouldn't trade a sunburn for a trophy fish? But why do it if you don't have to? Especially when this Solar Stream Elite hoodie is built with broad-spectrum UV protection. We're talking UPF 50. And it has airflow so you don't overheat. And what's the alternative? Putting down the rod every half hour so you can slather on some sunscreen. Seems like an easy choice to me. Columbia PFG has you covered with their Castback TC shoe. Its OmniMax cushioning and traction system helps if you're on your feet a lot, say, fighting a fish. Not to mention keeping you sure-footed on a wet rocking boat. So if you're going to be spending long days out on the water, and I sincerely hope that you will be, head over to Columbia.com/PFG and shop all their performance fishing gear.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
May I ask, is Dr. Judy Resnick nearby?
Yes, sir, Mr. President.
Well, Judy, how is it, your first flight? How is it going? Is it all that you hoped it would be?
It certainly is, and I couldn't have picked a better crew to be flying with.
That's President Ronald Reagan calling the crew of the space shuttle Discovery on September 1st, 1984, and chatting with Judith Resnick, who a few days earlier had become the second American woman to go into space. Not that Judy, that's what everyone called her, cared much about the distinction of being first or second.
It's a profession for me, and the excitement is there every day.
As she once told her father, she just wanted to be known as an astronaut, period. In fact, she was a lot more than that.
Funny, good-looking, and very sociable. She had just incredible talents.
In academics?
She'd sit in class. She would just get it all and understand it. This is a woman who is brilliant.
In music?
She just loved piano, and she was an incredible pianist.
And in the kitchen?
The three lessons she taught me about cooking were, you know, number one, double the garlic, two, half the salt, and then stir with your right hand while you drink with your left.
That's Mike Oldak. He met Judy in college at Carnegie Tech, today known as Carnegie Mellon. The two would later marry.
My roommate introduced us, and that was it.
And was there an instant chemistry?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. It progressed pretty quickly. We just sort of settled in together.
Judy had grown up in Akron, Ohio, the daughter of Ukrainian Jewish immigrants. She was close with her father, but had a complicated relationship with her mother. Life at home wasn't always easy. Her parents would divorce when she was a teen, but that didn't seem to hold her back. She showed so much promise as a musician, she considered becoming a concert pianist. She was a star student, getting a perfect score on her SATs and graduating as valedictorian of her class. She had the, quote, brain of a scientist and the soul of a poet, her father Marvin Resnick would later say. At Carnegie, Judy started off as a math major, but after attending some of Mike's classes, she switched to electrical engineering, becoming one of only three women in that field at the university.
Do you think she was intimidated by being one of just three women in the program?
I don't think she was intimidated. She just took it in stride. Her abilities just paved the way.
After graduation in 1970, Judy and Mike tied the knot and both took jobs in the Missile and Surface Radar Division of RCA. Sidebar, I can't be the only one who hears RCA and instantly thinks of a little dog listening to an old-timey phonograph. Great logo, right? Well, RCA was also a major defense contractor, building advanced weapons systems.
I will admit, Judy was paid more than me. It was back in 1970. We both came on as design engineers, and she got more money than I did, and she graduated a lot higher than I did.
Mike ended up switching careers to law, while Judy stayed in engineering, while also going to school, eventually getting her PhD.
She developed a few things that RCA patented. This was in large-scale integration for computers. She was so competent that it didn't seem like an effort for her.
It was a busy and exciting time. But in 1975, Judy and Mike made the difficult decision to end their marriage. Why didn't the marriage work?
I've heard it described as a failed marriage, and I reject that. I think it's more of Judy and I decided that we really wanted different things out of our future. I wanted a family, and at that point, she had changed her mind and decided she did not want a family. You know, I always believe that not all people in love should be married. And we sort of let each other go and do our own things. We stayed very close.
Judy headed west to California and a new adventure. In 1976, NASA announced that it was, quote, committed to an affirmative action program with a goal of having qualified minorities and women among the newly selected astronaut candidates for its brand new space shuttle program. The celebrity who became a spokesperson for this campaign?
I'm speaking to the whole family of humankind, minorities and women alike. If you qualify and would like to be an astronaut, now is the time.
The late, great Nichelle Nichols.
This is your NASA. A space agency embarked on a mission to improve the quality of life on planet Earth right now.
Who had famously played Lieutenant Uhura on Star Trek.
Transmission to Starfleet complete, sir.
Nichols used her star power, so to speak, traveling around the country to recruit a next generation of astronauts. Among those who answered NASA's recruitment call, Judith Resnick.
When you were a little girl growing up in Akron, Ohio, did you say, gee, I'd like to be an astronaut someday?
No, I really didn't think about it until when NASA announced that they were looking for astronauts who would be engineers and scientists on the space shuttle, and I just took a chance and applied.
Making it her goal to be the best candidate she could be, Judy got her pilot's license and underwent intense training to get into physical shape. It worked. By 1978, she was in.
This is Judy Resnick, age 29. She has a doctorate in electrical engineering and is one of America's first woman astronauts. She and 34 other new astronauts began their training today at the Johnson Space Center.
In her astronaut class, Judy was one of six women, including Sally Ride. Judy threw herself into the rigorous years-long shuttle training, but also knew when to have a little fun. She went by the nickname JR, not clear if it had anything to do with the TV show Dallas, a huge hit at the time. A fellow astronaut would remember Judy as a live wire and a star attraction during trips and happy hour. If Judy had any desire to become the first American woman in space, she didn't say so out loud.
What kind of mission do you want to fly, do you know?
I'd like to fly any mission, actually. The intent of a mission specialist is to train us to be generalists and to learn a little bit about every field, and I'd be glad to fly in anything that they let me fly.
And when the time came for crew assignments in 1983, it turned out Judy would have to wait.
Some U.S. space history is to be made out there on Launch Pad 39A. For the first time, an American woman will be launched into space. Her name is Sally Ride.
Quick history lesson here. While Sally Ride was the first American woman in space, she was not the first woman in space. That honor went to Soviet cosmonaut Valentina Tereshkova, who had soared into the record books back in 1963, 20 years before Ride.
And as the first ever space girl, Valentina Tereshkova has won a place in history. What a triumph for Russian science.
Now, Sally Ride's ride was still a very big deal. And just 1 year later, it was Judy's turn.
She was a mission specialist on the Space Shuttle Discovery.
We have SRB ignition and we have liftoff. Liftoff of mission 41D, the first flight of the orbiter Discovery, and the shuttle has cleared the tower.
As the shuttle went into orbit, Judy radioed back to mission control that Earth looks great. She had serious work to do, but in photos and videos from the mission, she looks like she's having the time of her life. She holds up a sign that reads, "Hi, Dad." In the background, you can see an I Heart Tom Selleck sticker slapped onto her locker. This was in his Magnum PI heyday. At one point, she dons aviator sunglasses. Now, Judy had become the second American woman to go into space, but she was also the first Jewish astronaut to go into space. It's another distinction she wasn't vocal about, but her former husband, Mike Oldak, says there's more to the story.
I think that's misconstrued that she had given up her Judaism, and I think anything but. Judy did not want to be known as the first Jewish astronaut. As she said directly to me, "I'm an astronaut who happens to be a woman, who happens to be Jewish, who happens to have brown hair." She was very firm in saying, "That's who I am." She didn't want the other labels, Jewish, woman, brown hair.
Well, the only issue I have with that, if I may, is that she had amazing hair.
Yes.
I mean, she really did.
Yes. Yeah.
That was the first real hair in space.
Yeah. I think most of those other astronauts were former Air Force pilots and had buzz cuts.
Discovery's mission went off without a hitch.
Of course, the first landing for Discovery after a maiden flight that's been termed a major success.
If flying into outer space made Judy nervous, she didn't sound like it. As she told one writer, "It does not enter any of our minds that it is dangerous. The world might think it is. We don't. I think something's dangerous only if you're not prepared for it or you don't have control over it." Less than 2 years after Judy's voyage on Discovery came her next mission, aboard the Challenger.
And liftoff of the 25th Space Shuttle mission, and it has cleared the tower.
Where did you watch the launch from?
I actually was at my office, and we didn't really have too many TVs there. And I got a call from my mother in tears, telling me that the shuttle had blown up.
On the morning of January 28, 1986, the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded 73 seconds after liftoff, killing all seven crew members aboard, including civilian astronaut and teacher Krista McAuliffe and Judith Resnick.
Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction.
It happened to be my 17th birthday. I was a junior in high school, and I can still see the student who ran into the cafeteria at lunch and told us. I just remember I couldn't believe it.
The crew of the Space Shuttle Challenger honored us for the manner in which they lived their lives. We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them this morning, as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye and slipped the surly bonds of Earth to touch the face of God.
An investigation would later determine that unexpectedly cold temperatures had impacted the O-ring seals in one of the rocket boosters, causing an explosion. I think a lot of us had forgotten that space travel could be dangerous. The shuttle was just so sleek. On TV, it looked almost like a high-tech toy. It didn't seem risky at all, but of course it was. In the years after the explosion, the U.S. government and Morton Thiokol, the manufacturer of the rocket boosters, would attempt to settle with the families of the Challenger crew. The initial offers were calculated with a formula, factoring in whether a crew member was survived by a spouse and or children. Judy's former husband, Mike Oldak, by then a practicing attorney, didn't think this was fair and took legal action on behalf of the Resnick family.
Each spouse would get X. Each child would get Y. Oh, Judy's not married and didn't have any kids. Oh, too bad. We'll give her, you know, just a small amount. And I said, no. Finally, after about a year and a half, settled with Martin Thiokol for exactly what Judy's father and brother wanted.
What was motivating you?
When I decided that engineering made a better hobby than a profession, and I became a full-time law student, and so she was the big breadwinner in our family. Judy put me in law school. I felt I owed her family, and I wanted to do it.
How will you remember Judy? If there's one image that pops into your mind when you think of her, what is it?
Probably just smiling. I mean, she was a very happy person and smiled a lot and knew what she wanted.
Judith Resnick wasn't the first woman in space. She's probably not the first name that comes to mind when you think about the crew of the Challenger. She probably would be fine with that. Number one, number two, they were just numbers to her. She wanted to do something significant, not necessarily be someone significant. Judy was an astronaut. She was also an exceptional human being who deserved all the recognition she never quite received. I certainly hope you enjoyed this Mobituary. May I ask you to please rate and review our podcast? You can also follow Mobituaries on Facebook and Instagram, and you can follow me on Twitter at Moraka. Hear all new episodes of Mobituaries every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts. And check out Mobituaries, Great Lives Worth Reliving, the New York Times best-selling book, now available in paperback and audiobook. It includes plenty of stories not in the podcast. This episode of Mobituaries was produced by Jake Harper, Zoe Marcus, Mo Rocca, Aaron Schrank, and Wilco Martinez-Cachero. It was edited by Maura Walls and engineered by Josh Hahn, with fact-checking by Naomi Barr. Our production company is Neon Hum Media. Our archival producer is Jamie Benson. Our theme music is written by Daniel Hart. Indispensable support from Craig Swagler, Dustin Gervais, Alan Peng, Reggie Bazil, and everyone at CBS News Radio. Special thanks to Alberto Rabina. The inestimable Aaron Schrank is our senior producer. Executive producers for Mobituaries include Steve Razies and me, Mo Rocca. The series is created by yours truly. And as always, undying gratitude to Rand Morrison and John Karp for helping breathe life into Mobituaries.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. If tonight's movie night is just what you need, make it special with the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.